Imagine you're reading a book, and as you're reading through this book keeps saying, as you know from this other book, or as this other book points out, or keeps making references to allusions, and eventually you might begin to say, boy, if I'm really going to understand what I'm reading, I need to go to that first book to know what's going on. So you read through the Bible, it becomes pretty clear you need to understand the Pentateuch if you're going to understand the rest of the Bible. It's constantly referencing things that occur in the Pentateuch, quotations from there, allusions to there. And in the Pentateuch, it becomes pretty clear if you're going to understand the Pentateuch, you need to understand Genesis, because there are themes that Moses lays out in Genesis to prepare you for the rest of the Pentateuch. That Moses is writing the Pentateuch for the nation of Israel as they're getting ready to go into the land of Canaan so they'd understand who they are and who God is and what he expects of them. And if you're going to understand the book of Genesis, you really have to understand the Abrahamic covenant. And that means, in some senses, the Abrahamic covenant is a foundational truth for all of the Bible. Because you have to understand it to understand Genesis. You have to understand Genesis to understand the Pentateuch. You have to understand the Pentateuch to understand the Bible. We've been going through a series on biblical foundations. When I originally thought I was going through this series, I thought I'd stop at Genesis chapter 11 as kind of a natural breaking point in the book of Genesis. The more I thought about it, the more I realized we can't not talk about the Abrahamic covenant if we're going to talk about biblical foundations. And so, Lord willing, this evening, we're going to try to do kind of a survey through the narrative in Genesis about the Abrahamic covenant to begin to understand what it is that's going on. And the Abrahamic covenant is very central to the Genesis narrative. The first 11 chapters that we've gone through so far, we've covered thousands of years. Starting in chapter 12, for the next 13 chapters, we cover 25 years. So the narrator obviously slows down quite a bit once we get here to Genesis chapter 12 and begins to focus a lot more on what's going on. It's interesting, too. I don't know that you can make too much of this, but there are different section headings in the book of Genesis. I've pointed this out. You're there in chapter 12. Go back up to chapter 11 and verse 10. These are the records of the generations of Shem. Go down to verse 27 of Genesis 11. Now, these are the records of the generations of Terah. And you have that heading 11 times in the book of Genesis. Starts in chapter 2, goes all the way through to the end. And the one we're in right here, the one that starts there in verse 26, is the sixth, which makes it the middle one. In a sense, this is the center of the book of Genesis. Now, this genealogy in chapter 11, now I'm not going to take time to really study through 11, 10, through the end of the chapter, in part because we touched on this already several weeks ago and talked about the age of the earth. But if you do read through this genealogy, it becomes clear it's a little bit different from a previous genealogy. In chapter 5, we saw genealogy going from Seth down to Noah. And one of the things that got repeated several times in that genealogy was so-and-so lived so many years, had this son, had other sons and daughters, lived so many more years, and then he died. And then he died. And then he died. This genealogy has similar things. He lived so many years, had this son, had other sons and daughters, lived so many years, but it doesn't say he died. In some ways, it seems as if we're beginning to move toward hope, that maybe there's hope against death. And that hope is found with what comes at the end of the genealogy with Terah, who then has Abram. So then we find the unfolding of Abraham and his story. Now, why is this genealogy here? Why are the other genealogies here in the book of Genesis? There's even more if you keep going through. And it's because Moses is giving a history. He's helping the nation of Israel to understand they didn't come out of nowhere. They have a history, and that history goes back to Abraham, and Abraham goes back to Noah, and Noah goes back to Adam. And so what God is doing with the nation of Israel is tied to his purposes in creation. He is the God of everything, the heavens and the earth. And so what God intends for the nation of Israel is tied to his purposes more broadly in all of the world. But I also want to make sure we don't miss out on the fact that as we transition now to chapter 12, and you keep reading through the rest of Genesis, which we're not going to cover because we only have a couple weeks left, but you don't really see a shift in the way things are described. Sometimes people want to treat Genesis 12 and forward as history, and chapters 1 through 11 as kind of poetic in some ways. But there may be historical truths behind it, but in many ways, it's mythical in nature. But these genealogies, I think, remind us these aren't myths, these are history. These are actual people who lived actual years, had actual sons and daughters. And so it's not as though if we come to chapter 12 and now we're in a whole different kind of genre. Now it's a whole different kind of narrative. It's the same history that Moses has been laying out since the beginning of creation until we get to Abraham. And now as we work through this, we'll find several places in the Genesis narrative in which God comes and either explicitly mentions a covenant that he is forming with Abraham, or specific promises that show up several times. And so we'll start here in chapter 12 and the first three verses. These are some of the most important verses in Scripture. And in some ways, these form the essence of God's promise to Abraham. Now, it's fleshed out more in the narrative, but this introduces us and gives us, in many ways, the heart of what God intends to do with Abraham. Chapter 12 and verse 1, "Of the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you." And so he gives a command in a sense to separate himself from his father. And in some ways, I think this coming right on the heels of the Table of Nations in chapter 10, and then the Tower of Babel in chapter 11, we're seeing God's taking Abraham out of sinful humanity. He's pulling him out from sinful humanity and setting him apart. And what will he do? In verse 2, there are three promises. "I will make you a great nation, I will bless you, and I will make your name great." At the end of verse 2, some people think this is a command. Be a blessing. I think the best way to understand it is the way that the NASB translates it here. It's a sense saying, and this will be the consequence. This is the intention. This is why I'm doing this. I'm going to do these things so that you will be a blessing. And so there's a blessing that in some way is channeled through Abraham and through his offspring. And so we find three more promises then in the next verse. "I will bless those who bless you," and one, it's actually two promises. "I bless those who bless you and curse, and those who curse you, I will curse." I think those are tied together. "And then in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed." So there's a worldwide blessing through Abraham. And I think we're beginning to see this emphasis on blessing in some ways is cluing us in. This is going to be the answer to the curse. Remember Genesis chapter 3, there's a curse that God puts on the earth, on creation, and yet there's going to be the seed of the woman. And so here we have a promise. We have a promise of blessing that's going to come through Abraham. And so this is how God is ultimately going to reverse the curse. And Abraham obeys in verse 4. He does what God calls him to do. And in verse 7, God comes to him again and gives one more promise of blessing. "The Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'To your descendants, I will give this land.'" So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Now there in verse 7, when you see that word descendants, that is the word for seed or offspring. It's the offspring of the woman that we've already talked about. So it's the descendant of the woman. Here we're seeing the same word applied, the descendants of Abraham. So here we see an initial promise of blessing. You go to chapter 13 and you find another section in which God lays out his promises to Abraham. Chapter 13, the initial part of the chapter, there's the fight between Abraham and Lot. And in some ways, Abraham immediately puts the promise that God gave at risk. God said, I'm going to give you this land. And then Abraham tells Lot, well, you pick, where do you want to go? But Lot doesn't pick the land that God promised. Remember last week, talked about the Tower of Babel in Genesis. Going eastward seems to be a problem. Lot says, I'm going to go eastward. Move away from where God's promise and blessing is. And so the land is still secure. And in verse 14 of chapter 13, God comes to Abraham again. And he says, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. So now we have a new element here given. How long is this land going to be here? Forever. It's yours. For you and your descendants. And I will make your descendants, your offspring, as the dust of the earth. So that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. And so in verse 17, arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. And so in a sense, basically saying, show that it belongs to you. Walk around, demonstrating this is yours. And it's not explicit, but as we read through the narrative, I think we can rightly assume Abraham did exactly what God called him to do here. He walked through the land, demonstrating that he believed this was land that God was going to give to Abram. The next time we find a discussion about God's promises and about his covenant is in chapter 15. We would go to chapter 15. And in this section, we first find that word covenant being used, in which God gives a covenant to Abraham. In verse 1, the Lord appears to Abraham in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abraham, I'm a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. Now, why does he say, do not fear? Well, it could be because anytime there's a vision, anytime there's an angel, there's a tendency for people to say, I'm a little nervous about this. But I think probably the fear is tied to the question Abram gives in the next verse. This is actually the first time we see Abram speak in the narrative. Here in chapter 15 and verse 2, he says, Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. In a sense, he's uncertain how God's going to fulfill his promise. I don't think this is a demonstration of unbelief on his part, because in a few verses, Moses is going to point out he is exercising faith. But he's questioning, how is this going to come about? I know you've said this, but how's it going to work? I don't have any children. And so the Lord once again reminds him, it's not going to be a servant. Verse 3-4, it's going to be your own body. Someone who comes forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And in verse 5, he does something similar to what he did earlier. He said, look at the dust of the earth. Can you count it? Now he says, look at the stars of the heaven. Can you count the stars? You don't have any children right now, Abraham. But you'll have so many, you can't even count them. They'll be greater than anyone could number. And in verse 8, Abraham gives a second question. Sorry, before we get to verse 8, verse 6, I don't want to miss this one. Verse 6 is one of the most important texts in the Bible. Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And the NASB here translates it, then he believed in the Lord. I think actually the best way to understand this is something like the effect of, now Abraham had believed. Because I don't think the syntax is saying, this is the next thing that happens in this narrative. It's actually the narrator saying, now understand this had already occurred. Understand this is the context in which this event is occurring. The context is Abraham had believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now, why is that important? Well, in part because I don't think we'd say, well, Abraham hadn't believed God yet. Chapter 12, when God said, go out and I'm going to do these things, Abraham hadn't believed yet. He didn't believe in chapter 13, but now in chapter 15, he finally believed. In fact, in the New Testament, we find the whole reason that Abraham went out from his family was he did so by faith. Now, the narrator wants to make sure that's clear because God's about to enter into a covenant relationship with Abraham, a formal covenant relationship. And he wants to be clear that he does so that the covenant is not what makes Abraham righteous. That God has already made him, declared him to be righteous because of his faith. He's declared him to be righteous. He's reckoned him as righteous, and therefore he can enter into this covenant relationship with God. So in verse 8, he has this second question. And it's interesting, the first part of the chapter focused on the seed, right? The stars of heaven. Beginning in verse 7, it shifts to the land, right? I gave you this land to possess it. And in verse 8, how will I know? What assurance do I have that this promise will be true? And so in the rest of this section, we then find a ritual that occurs. Verse 9, God says to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. And he brought all these things to him, and he cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds. He's saying, wait a minute, why is he cutting these? What's going on? And I think it's because Abraham knew when God asked him to bring these animals what it was that God was doing. In a sense, this was how people entered into a covenant relationship. They would take animals, they would cut them in half and lay them on either side, and then they would walk through the midst saying, we agree to this covenant, and if we fail to fulfill our end of the bargain, then we deserve to have happen to us what happened to these animals. And one of the reasons I think that's the case is because of what we find in Jeremiah 34. Keep your finger or bookmark or something here in Genesis 15. Go to Jeremiah 34 and verse 17. Jeremiah 34, verse 17. Therefore, thus says the Lord, you have not obeyed me in proclaiming release each man to his brother and each man to his neighbor. Behold, I am proclaiming a release to you, declares the Lord, to the sword, to the pestilence and to the famine, and I will make you a terror to all the kingdoms of the earth. I will give the men who have transgressed my covenant, who have not fulfilled the words of the covenant which they made before me, when they cut the calf in two and passed between its parts, the officials of Judah, the officials of Jerusalem, the court officers, the priests, all the people of the land who passed between the parts of the calf, I will give them into the hand of their enemies, in the hand of those who seek their life. Their dead bodies will be food for the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth. And so what is happening back in Genesis 15 is this covenant ritual. And so Abraham takes these animals, cuts them in half, and puts them on either side. But then Abraham falls into a deep sleep. And God speaks to Abraham. And he introduces new information about his seed. In verse 13, know for certain that your descendants, your offspring, will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. So here, this is what's going to happen. And he does so because, verse 16, the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So God's going to put them there, it'll be there 400 years, and then he's going to bring them to this land that he has promised. And in verse 17, we find that God appears as a smoking oven and a flaming torch, and only God walks in the middle between these two, between the torn creatures. Because he is saying, I alone am responsible for fulfilling this covenant. And so in a sense, he's saying, if it were possible for me to be destroyed, let me be so if I did not fulfill the promise that I am making to you, Abraham. And so here, again, the emphasis is on the land. Verse 18. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants, I've given this land. From the river of Egypt, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, in chapter 17, we find another discussion about God entering into a covenant. And some people have wondered, well, didn't God just enter into a covenant in chapter 15? So why is he making a covenant in chapter 17? Liberals say, well, that's because these are two different sources that the person kind of slapped together without really thinking carefully about it. I think we understand that's not what Moses has done. And so what is going on here? Is this a new covenant? I think no. It's, in some ways, you might think about it like Deuteronomy. If you remember Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. It's the renewal and reaffirmation of the Mosaic covenant. This is a reaffirmation. This is not a new covenant. This is reaffirming the covenant that God has already made with Abraham. So chapter 17, verse 1, when Abram was 90 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I'm the Lord God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, and I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him. And in this chapter, we find, in a sense, three sections. The first section is focusing on God and what God is going to do. And what God is going to do is he is going to give Abraham a seed. He's going to give him offspring. And in particular, this offspring is going to include kings. Verse 6, I'll make you exceedingly fruitful. I'll make nations of you, and kings will come forth from you. And how do we know that he's going to do this? Well, he gives a sign in verse 5. You have a new name now. Your name's not Abram, but Abraham. You're going to be the father of many nations. Beginning in verse 9, the focus shifts from God to Abraham. Look, as for you. Now, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about you. What are you going to do? Well, you're going to keep my covenant. And how are you going to demonstrate that? You're going to do so through circumcision. And so there's a sign here. You're going to demonstrate your allegiance to this covenant through circumcision. Then in verse 15, it shifts to Sarah. As for Sarah, your wife, new sign again, she's going to get a new name. Sarah shall be her name because she is going to be the mother. It's not going to be Hagar and Ishmael. It's going to be Sarah and Isaac. And then it ends in verses 23 to 27 with Abraham obeying and demonstrating once again his faith by circumcising himself and his children. And it's interesting, Ishmael is circumcised. Ishmael wasn't the direct recipient of this promise. And yet, the promise has implications for him, because Abraham is the father of many nations, and Ishmael will receive blessings through Abraham. And so he, as well, is circumcised to demonstrate belief in that promise. Chapter 18, verses 17 to 19, it's in the middle of when God is coming to Abraham and talking about his plans to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And he says, I'm going to tell you what I'm doing in verse 17. Why? Verse 18, since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed, for I have chosen him. It's not him, it's me. I'm the one who is going to do this. And then in chapter 22, we find the story of Abraham offering up Isaac. And right before he gets ready to kill him, the angel comes and says, now I know that you love me. And so the angel appears to Abraham in verse 15 of chapter 22 and says, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you've done this thing, have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you. And I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand was on the seashore. Right? We've already seen those, right? He's saying, I'm going to do this. Remember I said that? I'm going to do it. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. This is the last time in the narrative about Abraham that we find any discussion about the covenant. But it shows up at least two more times in the next two narratives. Go to chapter 26 and verse 1. Here, God comes to Isaac in Genesis 26. And in verse 2 says, do not go down to Egypt, but stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants, to your offspring, I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father, Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. I will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And then as well, it shows up to Jacob in chapter 28. As Jacob has the vision of the ladder. In verse 13, God speaks to him and says, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your offspring. Your offspring will also be like the dust of the earth. You will spread out to the west, the east, the north, and south. And in you and in your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you till I have done what I have promised you. Lord willing, next week we're going to come back and try to tease out more specifically what it is that God's promising to Abraham. We've seen several things being discussed. We've seen promises of offspring, of blessing for Abraham, of a great name, of being made a great nation, a blessing for those who bless Abraham and cursing for those who do not. The promise of the land shows up several times. A promise that all nations of the earth, there's worldwide blessing that's going to come through Abraham and through his offspring. And that God will be with Abraham. He'll be with Isaac. He'll be with Jacob. That they will have kings who come from their offspring. We'll tease out what all of that is and try to understand what it is that God promises to that. But for this evening, I want to just think about a few things that we have seen in working through this narrative. One is it's very clear of God's sovereign election. Mentioned this back in chapter 10, but Eber, who we said might be where we get the name Hebrew, had two sons, Joktan, Peleg. But then Peleg isn't mentioned. His offspring isn't mentioned there because his offspring is going to come back there in chapter 11. And through his offspring, we're going to have Abram. And so God says, not Joktan, but Peleg. God says, not Nahor, but Abram. God says, not Ishmael, but Isaac. Why? Because he chooses. There's nothing in Abram. There's no value in Abram. God simply chose him. God simply chose Isaac. God simply chose Jacob. It's not our works, but it's God's election. And our response is faith. And faith is not just itself valuable. It's valuable because of the one in whom we're exercising it. Abram believed God and was counted to him as righteousness. As well, we see that faith demonstrates itself in obedience. So what is Abraham doing throughout this narrative? Generally, whatever God says, but not perfectly. Which helps us to see that with faith and obedience, there still can be sin and doubt. That Abraham doesn't always make the best choice. That Abraham battles even with unbelief in some ways through this narrative. Pretty early on, he goes down to Egypt rather than trusting God to keep him in the land where he is. Then when he gets there, he doesn't trust God to protect Sarah, but gives Sarah, allows Sarah to go to Pharaoh. And all of a sudden now, there's actually a concern because what did God say? It's going to be an offspring to you. Well, is it going to be yours or is it going to be Pharaoh's? What does God do? Well, he makes sure it's clear. Pharaoh did not sleep with Sarah. Then it happens later with Abimelech. That God is preserving and protecting Abraham and his promises, even though Abraham is not always perfectly obeying. And yet, he is set up as an example of faith and obedience. They believed God and therefore did what God called him to do. And in doing so, he's set up as the opposite of the people of the Tower of Babel. In the Tower of Babel, what did they say? We're going to make a name for ourselves by building ourselves a city. And God comes to Abraham, and what does he say? Go. Be a sojourner. Be a stranger. There's a promise given to you, and yet you won't experience it in your life. That's what the author of Hebrews points out in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 9 to 11. By faith, he lived as a stranger in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. Why? For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. When does that city come? On the Tower of Babel, what did they try to do? Let's build a tower to get up to heaven. Didn't work. What happens in Revelation 21? The city of Jerusalem comes from heaven down to earth. Because God is the one who will fulfill his promises for his people.